You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Craig Johnson. He's an independent journalist, academic scholar, researcher, and host of the podcast 15 Minutes of Fascism. He's also the author of a new book, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. Welcome to the Exchange, Craig.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here. Wish we were talking about something less scary.
Well, before we get into your book, let's talk more about you. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the St. Louis metropolitan area, somewhere between the Midwest and the South, as I usually describe it.
Now, tell me about your childhood.
Well, I was a studious, bookish kid. When I first tried to play sports, I didn't know that I needed glasses, and so I couldn't catch a ball to save my life. So I ended up reading a lot. I loved school. Small group of close-knit friends. Typical goody-two-shoes, I guess.
How'd you develop an interest in studying fascism and its influence on different societies?
Well, I am primarily a person who is motivated by concern about, you know, what's the worst that could happen, right? And when it comes to what's the worst that could happen to a human society, a lot of, you know, the correct answers, in my opinion, would be that it descends into fascism. I also have in my family, actually, somebody who, at least as far as I'm aware, had some interest in neo-Nazism. And that was a real wake-up call for me when I realized that when I was an adolescent.
When did you have any realization of the different types of governing forces?
Well, I mean, in school, we learned a lot about different types of government, different ways that people made decisions, different types of things that people could do and want to do. But fascists were always depicted as, you know, bad guys, people that nobody could ever conceivably actually want to be with. But when I realized, you know, in my adolescence that there were people who did agree with this, that they did want it, that it was, you know, their earnest belief that fascism was the right way to go, it was really amazing to me. It was really surprising. And I wanted to understand how and why people might get drawn to that.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I don't know too many 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds that understand what fascism is.
Yeah, I've always been interested in history. Always been interested in the dark side of the mirror, basically things that are the disturbing parts of how human societies work. It was always something that was fascinating and frightening to me. Essentially, you know, as a contrast to my not exactly white picket fence. Well, actually, I guess you know some of the houses I've lived in have had white picket fences.
Okay, so middle class America. Did you have any siblings?
I have one sibling.
Do they have any interest in fascism? Do you have these discussions with them?
Oh, I certainly talk with members of my family about and people in my life about fascism and what's going on in the world. You know, I end up talking about fascism and its dangers in a lot of my everyday conversations because it's my shop talk. You know, it's what I did today is I read some terrifying essay that somebody wrote, or I spent a while trying to figure out who somebody is, or I, you know, did some archival work looking into some magazine that they made or something like that. For me, it's bread and butter.
Is your sibling a brother, sister, older, younger?
He is a younger brother.
How much younger?
A couple years.
Has he read your book?
I believe so.
Well, I'd like for you to read your book. Can you read an excerpt from your book's introduction?
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. So this is from page 3 of the book. Consider this book as an answer to these two questions. Why do young men join the right wing? And how can we stop them from doing it? Neither of these is a new question. People have been asking them for as long as there's been a right wing. But this book will address these questions practically with advice and strategies that you can use in your everyday life. When I was a graduate student and would tell people I studied fascism, they'd often end the conversation by asking me what they can do to stop it. And there are a lot of things you can do. You can vote against them when they run for office, be open with friends and family about your opposition to fascism, and work with big organizations that are opposing its rise. All of these have proven track records of stopping fascism from taking over countries or from heavily influencing them. But there are other things we can do in our everyday lives that help stop the rise of fascism, and one of the most important of these is to stop the growth of their power base. As you'll learn by reading this book, that power base is overwhelmingly full of young men who belong to whatever ethnic, racial or religious group constitutes the majority of their country. In India, this is Hindus. In Spain, it's Catholics. And in the United States, this is white people. Fascists are also overwhelmingly male everywhere they appear. This has been true in the past, and it's true today with groups like the Proud Boys, Patriot Front, and the Groypers, consisting almost exclusively of men. Many commentators have noted this before, and there have been a lot of good discussions about the work that white people or men need to do in their own communities and spaces to help slow or stop the rise of fascism. But there's less attention to the fact that many fascists are young. This isn't to say that there aren't older fascists. Like with any political movement, there's always an older generation that holds the wisdom from the past and educates the youth about it. But when it comes to new fascists, the majority of them are young. That means that the youth of young men is a critical time to intervene and stop them from developing fascist politics or joining fascist organizations, so that instead of being influenced by fascist elders, they're influenced by anti-fascist ones. Recent studies have shown an uptick in concern over youth radicalization throughout the Western world.
My guest is Craig Johnson, author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. So, Craig, let's start with defining these terms that are thrown around in your book. We'll start with fascism. What is that?
Absolutely. Fascism is a tough one to define. And so if folks find themselves unsure, like that, join the club. That's a relatively common position for folks to be in. Fascism is a revolutionary political movement. It's on the right wing. And the thing that differentiates it from the rest of the right wing, and especially from the rest of the mainstream right wing, you know, conservatives, folks like that, it's two main things. Fascism is revolutionary. It believes that it wants to remake the world. They don't care about the rules as written. They don't care about laws. They don't care about the Constitution in the case of the United States. They don't care about established norms in the cases of other countries that run more or less on that format. The other big thing that makes fascism different from other political movements is that fascists don't just believe that violence is useful. Fascists believe that violence is good. They believe that it is good to be violent and that it's good to experience violence. They think that violence does something good to a human society. Here we have to remember that fascism emerged from the crucible of World War I. It was World War I veterans who thought that their experience in the trenches would make them the new men who would lead a new world to a new future. That's what fascism is.
Okay, so you also mentioned two other terms. You mentioned right wing and you mentioned conservatism. Well, let's start with conservatism and then go to right wing. What is conservatism?
Conservatism is a political belief system that holds that traditional values, traditional ways of doing things are the correct way to do them. In the United States, it tends to be predominantly Christian, but in other countries, it tends to be predominantly in favor of whatever social, religious, ethnic group was or is dominant in that place. So, for example, in India, conservatism is about Hindu norms and Hindu practices, right? Conservatism is a status quo-oriented political belief system. They want to hold the course. They want to keep things steady. They don't want to rock the boat. That's what makes them different from fascists. Conservatives want things to move or change slowly, if at all. Whereas fascists want to, you know, in the words of the technocrats today, they want to move fast and break things.
Okay. And so what is right wing?
Well, the right wing is an umbrella term. It refers to all sorts of people and all sorts of political beliefs. It includes fascists. It includes conservatives. It includes libertarians. It includes most nationalists as well. So the right wing, as opposed to the left wing, is a term that we inherit historically from the French Revolution, when the people who wanted more conservative, more sort of authoritarian outcomes from the revolution sat on the right side of the chamber, and the people who wanted more liberatory, more what we might today describe as socialist outcomes from the revolution, they sat on the left side of the chamber.
Okay, so you mentioned left wing, which now we understand that's the left side of the chamber, but you also mentioned socialism. What is socialism?
Socialism is another tough one to describe. Most socialists today are indebted to the philosophical and economic theories of Karl Marx, although there are non-Marxist socialists out there. Generally, socialists want the government to be involved in organizing the economy to some extent, And they believe that doing so will empower and will empower people, and that it will reduce the amount of social, financial burdens that they experience. So it wants the government to be in charge of the economy to some extent.
So if I understand you correctly, socialism is about the government providing for the needs of the people.
Yes, I think that that's a good definition.
And what's Marxism?
Well, Marxism is a political belief system that derives from a particular German Jewish philosopher named Karl Marx. He is primarily known for his critique of capitalism that he wrote down in a book that was intended to be 7 volumes, but ended up only being 3. It's called Das Kapital. He's also known for being a revolutionary propagandist, along with his friend Friedrich Engels, writing the Communist Manifesto.
Okay, and so along with socialism and Marxism, we hear the companion word communism. What's that?
Well, communism is, according to Marx, and again, there are a lot of different types of communist theories and communist ideologies that don't necessarily have to do with Karl Marx. But the difference between communism and socialism, again, you know, to think about the difference between conservatism and fascism. Whereas socialists want the state to be involved in organizing the economy, most Marxist ways of depicting actual communism would involve the non-existence of the state. At this point, the economy no longer needs to be guided by some sort of state and is instead, in Marxist words, from each according to their ability to each according to their need.
Okay, and so the people who sit on the left side of the chamber, these are your more liberal-minded people. What is a liberal?
Well, that one's a tough one too. Originally, a liberal was somebody who wanted to oppose the power of the king. That's the origin of the phrase. And so these were people who wanted individual liberties. They wanted to have representatives in the legislature who actually got to decide things, stuff like that. In the United States, a liberal has come to mean somebody who is left of center. But in other countries, say for example, the United Kingdom or Australia, they still use the older definition of the term. So you might go, for example, to Australia and hear the platform of the Liberal Party and be like, well, but that's kind of conservative. I'm confused. That's the reason.
Well, it's kind of confusing because someone who wants more liberty or is more liberal sounds like the fascist who wants to change everything to be the kind of society they want, which ultimately would provide them more liberty.
I don't think that that's the case. Whereas it is true that fascists generally are the people who would benefit from fascism, right? The people who join these organizations, that join these groups, they are the people who might actually benefit from experiencing a fascist government. However, I would argue that fascism is bad for everybody, including those who might support it. The elimination of democracy is bad. Genocide is bad.
Okay, so you wrote, quote, "Fascism is on the rise because the conditions are ripe for it. There's a generation of young men who, honestly and accurately, can look into their future and see less power for them than their grandfathers had," end quote. When you say young men, you're referring to young white men, right?
In the United States' case, almost exclusively. However, not exclusively. There are a lot of young men in the United States, including, for example, some of the leaders of the Proud Boys, one of the largest and most powerful fascist organizations in the United States, who are not white. However, the vast majority of fascists in the United States are white, yes, but fascism itself is not directly connected to whiteness. It's directly connected to nationalism. And in the United States, the most powerful nationalists are the white nationalists because there's more of them. But in other countries, say, for example, India or the Philippines, or in some cases, Brazil, fascism is not necessarily directly connected to whiteness.
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds left before we have to take a break. Why do young white men feel entitled to resort to violence in American society when the power structure, which is completely controlled by white men, and the economy, which is completely controlled by white men, doesn't produce the outcomes they believe they're entitled to?
Well, they believe that the United States is a fallen society and that it was better when white men had more power. And that's the past, even if it's an imagined past, that they want to return to.
but white men are in charge of everything.
They claim that that is not true. And, you know, nobody can tell them otherwise.
Craig, who did you write this book for?
Well, I wrote this book for anybody who has a young person in their life, a young man, a young woman. So this is for parents, caretakers, teachers, educators, people who are involved in faith communities. If you're the grandparent to every kid on the cul-de-sac, this book is for you too.
Okay. Now, before the break, we were talking about why young white men turn to violence, and fascism is rooted in this idea of violence, as you told us before. And you said it's because they don't believe this society is working for them, and yet it's controlled by white men. Now, I want to flip the script and ask you this. What should young black and brown men do when they see that the power structure, which is controlled by white men, exhibiting institutional violence toward them, disproportionately imprisons them, marginalizes them in society, and creates laws and systems that undermine their progress and capacity to pursue their dreams in the world's richest nation, and then turns around and mocks them? Should black and brown men rise up in violence to overthrow the government like white men do?
That is a big, big, big political question about the efficacy of violence in order to transform the world. That's a can of worms that I'm not going to jump into right now. When it comes to how young men who are not white in the United States should be engaging in politics, I think my answers, to the extent that I'm really capable of giving them as somebody who is myself white, I would say that the way to engage in politics is the way that you feel the most connected to, the way that gets you out of bed in the morning and keeps you fighting the good fight.
Okay, so where does this notion come from that some white men feel they are entitled to lash out against the government when they see a few non-white people achieve a reasonable level of prosperity in a white-centric nation that has targeted them with violence for generations?
Well, to a lot of young people especially, but also many, many, many white men in the United States, they think about politics as a zero-sum game. Any gain in privilege or power for people who are not white men, they think of as power that was taken from them, a position that they believe themselves to deserve that they don't have anymore. And so consequently, they think about it, you know, they think about it as deprivation. They think about it as loss. They think about it as something that was their birthright. You know, they use these terms. And so to them, a woman holding a position of privilege, a black man being the president of the United States, they think about that as deprivation. They think about it as oppression, in fact.
Wow. So that reminds me of the words of Sidney George Fisher. He wrote a popular book in the United States that was published in the 1860s, in 1860, the year Abraham Lincoln was elected president. And in fact, he was one of Lincoln's key endorsers. His book was titled The Laws of Race as Connected with Slavery. I want to quote from it, if I may.
Please.
Quote, "To understand slavery, we must understand the nature of the white man and of the Negro. Of these races, the white man is the highest in scale, the black the lowest. The white alone possesses the intellectual and moral energy, which creates that development of free government, industry, science, literature, and the arts, which we call civilization. The black can neither originate, maintain, nor comprehend civilization. He is by nature a barbarian. When in contact with the white race, he naturally and willingly yields to it and becomes its servant. The two races have exhibited these characteristics in all ages. The white race must, of necessity, by reason of its superiority, govern the Negro wherever the two live together," end quote. So Craig, Sidney George Fisher wasn't expressing hatred for black people. His ideology is rooted in a belief in racial hierarchy, which is the valuing and devaluing of humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy. Now, that belief was invented by white people, and it's the underlying current in American politics today. So in your research, do fascists identify with the ideology of racial hierarchy and white supremacy as articulated by Sidney George Fisher?
I would say that that's a pretty good encapsulation of what a lot of fascists believe, even if they are not explicitly talking about race. So, for example, I previously mentioned the Proud Boys, right? The Proud Boys' official position is that they are not a white supremacist or a white nationalist organization. The phrase that they use for themselves is, quote unquote, Western chauvinist. But what they mean by that is exactly what the author from the 19th century that you mentioned, That's precisely what this person is talking about. The idea that Western civilization, by which they mean, you know, Christian-dominated, white-dominated, male-dominated civilization that emerges in Europe, they think that that's the best thing that human beings have ever made. And so they think that inherently all other versions of civilization, of society, of thinking, of politics are inferior. And that's the message that they're peddling.
I'd like for you to read another excerpt from your book. It's near the end on page 128, starting with the sentence, "The point of this conversation."
Absolutely. Point of this conversation isn't to change the mind of the person you're talking to. You need to assume that their mind has been made up to the point that they won't listen to you or anyone else's arguments, at least in public. When it comes to arguing with people, think about formal debates like courtrooms or the kinds of debate societies they have at Oxford. In these settings, there are two sides, and both of them are obligated to promote their case above the other one by any means necessary. Their goal isn't to convince each other, but to convince the audience, the jury, or the other members of the debate club. Their opponent will never admit defeat on their own, and no evidence they can give or perspective they can share will get the opposition to acknowledge that they've lost. Debating in regular life is actually a lot like this too. Your opponent will almost never turn to you and say that you've made them change their mind. They'll probably dig in their heels and deny the evidence you give, or turn to debate tactics that insult you personally. If they're right wing, they might even start to threaten you or people you care about. Your job is to greet this behavior with calm resolve. If this person is a friend or someone you're close to and trust, they might hear you out and realize what they're saying is harmful or problematic. They might take your words to heart. Alternatively, and honestly more likely, they might just decide that talking to you about these subjects isn't worth it and will stop bringing them up around you. That may not be an ideal outcome, but it's an acceptable one when it comes to protecting your son from fascist ideology. Remember that when you're in conversations with your peers about politics, your goal isn't to convince them they're wrong on the spot. That's not how debates work. If you ever did high school debate or Model UN or anything similar, or if you've ever seen a movie about a trial, you know that the two sides in a debate rarely concede during the conversation itself. Both sides are there to represent themselves as best as possible in the moment so that the other people there can decide how well they've done. This is the reason that being the calmer, kinder person in a debate is so important. Acting this way might infuriate the person you're talking to, but it'll make you look like the more reasonable person to anybody around you. Remember, they're the people you're trying to get on your side, not the person you're debating. The need to stand up against fascism in public extends to social media and the online world too. When you see something that sounds right-wing, call it out. Sheltering yourself from it or ignoring it will not make it go away.
My guest is Craig Johnson, author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. Craig, what can white parents do to prevent the influence of fascist operatives from recruiting their teenagers?
Well, the biggest and most important thing to do is to express curiosity in your child's life. You need to understand that as they're going through adolescence, so, you know, somewhere between 10 and 25, as their brains are growing, as their social position is changing, they're developing politics on their own. They're becoming adults in that capacity. You can't make them believe something. What you can do is model good behavior, express curiosity in the things that they care about, and provide them with warnings, expertise, wisdom about these things that might be really, really hard for them to see or hear or understand. Essentially, the thing that you need to do is to talk to them about fascism in the same way that you might talk to them about rape culture, or about racism, or about sexism, as something that is in the world, that's part of the world, that's an evil, terrible thing in the world, that is going to try to get them to behave in ways that are really heinous and awful, and that instead we need to fight against them and work together against them.
Well, the focus of fascism seems to be, if I'm hearing you correctly, solely on sustaining the power structure of white Christian men and a societal order of white Christian male power over all others, including white women. Is that the basic premise?
In the United States, that is basically what they want.
Well, contrary to popular belief, not all fascists are uneducated, ignorant, and gullible. And you point to specific organizations on college campuses that are recruiting young, well-educated men.
Oh, certainly. Yes. There's a popular imagination, popular understanding of fascists, of neo-Nazis as being, you know, brutish barbarians. You know, people think about skinheads, right? But the fact is that a lot of these people are well-read, and there are philosophers and thinkers and, you know, all sorts of magazines and perspectives and, you know, pseudo-intellectuals peddling videos online that they can look to as examples of fascist thinking, of fascist philosophy, of fascist ideology. It's absolutely true that there are a lot of people on the right who think very hard about this position.
Well, I wonder, if your book is quite timely, because one of the questions that comes across my mind frequently is, how can parents educate their young men when they don't know their own history? Now, for example, during World War II, which white America remembers as this glorious victory for America over fascism, what they don't remember is that 24 members of Congress were indicted and went on trial in 1944, during World War II, for peddling Nazi propaganda and cooperating with Hitler's Nazi regime. And all of those folks, all 24 members of Congress, got away when the judge suddenly died. Now, that prosecuting attorney was the assistant attorney general, and he wrote two books on the subject. The last one was titled Our Vanishing Civil Liberties, and it warned of the rise of fascism in America, and that was 1949. And here we are today, hoping white parents can protect their kids from an influence that we inherited as a country that's been growing for the last two generations. Are we too late?
That's a question that I think about a lot. Sometimes it keeps me awake at night. We can't know the answer to that. The only thing that we can really know is that, sure, a better time to do a lot of this would have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, but the second best time is today.
Well, that's a good point. We were told in the mid-20th century that fascism has already been planted as a seed in our politics, our judicial systems, our prison system, our law enforcement, even in our business sectors and our economy. So now it's grown over these last two generations. What can parents do to learn this history that they were never taught?
Well, you know, the glib answer is you could buy and read my book, but there are a bunch of other sources and ways that one could encounter this too. If you go on Google, go to your bookstore, look for books that are about, for example, the Second Ku Klux Klan. The Second Klan, which was active in the United States during the 1920s and 1930s, which is probably the largest fascist organization the United States has ever seen. That's also a good blueprint for how to deal with them, how to end up surpassing them and defeating them. The trick, though, is that it involves the federal government being opposed to fascism, which it isn't really in the United States right now. The other thing that one can do is to work together with your coworkers, with people in your neighborhood, with people in your faith community, people at your kid's school, wherever. Organize, get together, work together. If you see fascism moving or rising in your community, talk about it, engage with the other people about it, deal with it, confront it. You cannot put your head in the sand here. That will only make it stronger. Instead, you have to have uncomfortable conversations.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, and you tell us in your book that the pervasive belief in society is that young white men get radicalized online from video games and violent language used in gamer culture, which can turn young white men into right-wing ideologues. And you also speak of videos on YouTube, TikTok, and other social media that reinforce right-wing tendencies. What else is missing in this influence equation?
I think that there's a lot missing, and it's stuff that you have brought up previously in this conversation. The fact is that white supremacism, male supremacism, Christian supremacism, these are inherent parts of much culture in the United States. So young boys, and especially young white boys in the United States, get these messages from all over the place. I heard some of them from relatives of mine, you know, and I'm sure that many other people listening here, or many people know people listening who are not unfamiliar with that experience. The fact is that this messaging comes from all over the place. And so parents need to be prepared. They need to be aware and ready to fight it wherever it comes.
And what do you want readers to take away from your book?
The big thing that I hope people can take away is that fascism's rise is not inevitable. Even though it's been doing very well for the last 10 or 15 years in the United States, that doesn't mean it'll work forever. Fascism has been defeated before, and it can be defeated again. We just need to work together.
And in the last 30 seconds, what are your recommendations for white parents today who perceive that their young teenager or adult is exhibiting symptoms of a belief in fascist ideology?
Well, the first thing to do is make sure that you're safe and that the people around you who are more vulnerable are safe. So that's young women, people who are non-binary, people of color. And then the second thing to do is to talk to this young man, express empathy about his experiences, curiosity about his ideas, and try to engage with him and see where he's at.
Well, that's good advice. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. So thank you very much for writing this book, and thanks for coming on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. I had a lovely conversation.
My guest was Craig Johnson, author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.